Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, despite confusing public health data, local government officials in 2020 helped people protect themselves from the spread of COVID. They were also targeted by community members angry over the killing of people of color by police officers. The city of Wauwatosa struggled to respond to all that, and the mayor, Dennis McBride, is with us to talk about his experience, and he kind of does it through his book that's just out. It's titled A City on the Edge, and the subtitle is Pandemic, Protest, and Polarization. He's going to be talking about his experience and his book, and I hope you'll join in. And you can share maybe how you survived 2020. Have you worked in local government? How did you deal with the pressures of your work, or how do you deal with them? Every community was affected, obviously, by COVID. And Dennis has written a fascinating book about his experience and really about government and government response during the COVID period. Again, join in with your own questions or your own experiences. Love to hear your experiences as well. The number 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Mayor Dennis McBride, welcome to the show. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
It is a privilege to be on the show, especially with you, Larry. You've been a superstar in public radio for so many years, so it's an honor. Thank you.
Had a lot of fun talking with your brother, Patrick McBride, about the book. Actually, you co-authored that book with him.
I did. That one was called The Luckiest Boy in the World. It was my brother's memoir, but he needed a journalism major to help him co-author this.
And you were a journalism major, but you brought a whole lot more to this whole business of being mayor. Before we get into it, talk about your own experience that certainly qualified you for the job.
Well, my mother was the vice chair of the state Democratic Party when I was a kid and during the Kennedy years. And she actually brought John F. Kennedy to Wauwatosa in 1960. She later became a political reporter for the Milwaukee Sentinel and covered the national convention. So I dedicated the book to her because if you don't like me, you can blame my mother for me being involved in public affairs. But early on, and because I grew up during the Kennedy years, and it was the centennial of the Civil War, I'm a big Abe Lincoln fan. I just fixed on the idea of becoming a public servant. And I got a journalism degree and a master's in public administration and a law degree, all with the intention of becoming a fully well-rounded public official. And I've served at every level of government, either as an intern or whatever. So
yes. Yeah. And you grew up in Wauwatosa.
I did.
And, I have some very recent connections with Wauwatosa from pretty much August of 2021 to May of 2025. My daughter was a student at Wisconsin Lutheran College.
Very good. In
marine biology. So I can't tell you how many times I've traveled from... Yes. From Madison to Wauwatosa, and I gotta say, I as I read your book, I was thinking, gosh, this is an amazing story, and I didn't know anything really about it, to be perfectly honest. Well, describe your hometown of Wauwatosa.
Well. First of all, Wauwatosa was founded in about 1835 by Yankee settlers from New England, and it was early on. It was an abolitionist community. We were stopped on the Underground Railroad. Two of our earliest churches were hiding places for escaped slaves. Unfortunately, like most American communities, we descended into segregation years after that, and we were a mostly white community, an all-white community until 1955. And now we're about 20% non-white. So Wauwatosa has gone through a lot of evolution. Mm-hmm. It's also gone through an evolution politically. We were very Republican. Now we're very Democratic. A lot of people said, well, why did all this happen in Wauwatosa? And I said, we're a mini metropolis. This is my favorite mayoral trivia that I'm about to give you. We're the 14th largest city in the state at night with just under 50,000 people. During the day, we're the fourth largest city in the state after Milwaukee, Madison, and Green Bay with over 105,000 people here, going to Wisconsin Lutheran College and other colleges, going to the state's busiest medical center, going to the state's busiest shopping mall. So we are we're a mini metropolis, mm-hmm. and we're the crossroads of the Milwaukee area. Mm-hmm. And the way I pitched the book was, and the first chapter is called Microcosm. We are a microcosm of everything that was going on in America in 2020. We had I walked into the pandemic. That was my first year as mayor.
April of 2020, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. So, and then we had 98 days and nights of racial protests, including 40 at my house. We then had a mass shooting at the state's busiest shopping mall, Mayfair Mall. And we were the community in Wisconsin that put Joe Biden over the top, in the state that put Joe Biden over the top in the Electoral College. So everything that was happening in America happened in my first 7 months as mayor. And so I sold the book on that. But of course, I don't just talk about Wauwatosa, Seattle, Portland, Minneapolis, Chicago, New York. I talk about all those things because obviously we were not alone in the challenges that we were facing.
Yeah. And, you know, I liked the review of what went on during that time period. I mean, I hadn't forgotten most of it, but I was reminded about when COVID came in and the spread of COVID. And you wrote a lot about that, sort of setting the stage for us for what was happening in Wauwatosa and elsewhere.
Well, and the editor said, we're not going to publish this book right away. I actually wrote it in 2021. He said, we're going to publish it in 2025. And of course, like every author, I wanted my book published tomorrow, not 5 years from now. But it made it a better book because as I wrote it and finished it and looked back 5 years, I realized that all of those things in 2020 are still with us.
Yeah,
we've had a lot of blowback. We're still arguing over vaccines. We're arguing over public health. Measles may turn into a pandemic. We've got a Nipah virus coming from India. Those things are going to be with us soon. We have all the polarization that we had in 2020 and then some. We still have protests going on across the country. We have the governmental response to that. Election denialism is still in the air. So all of those things that we grappled with in 2020 are still with us, including, of course, mass shootings.
And it all resulted, as you say, in changing the way we, as a people, behave.
Yes. The American Psychological Association did a report 3 years ago called Stress in America, and they pointed out that in their words, our society is experiencing the psychological impacts of a collective trauma. The pandemic created a collective experience among Americans. While the lockdown may seem like the distant past, the aftermath remains. And the report also noted the impact of global conflicts, racism and racial injustice, inflation and climate-related disasters on our psyche. So the question is, why was 2020 such a special year? Let's use special in air quotes.
Yeah.
In history, and why are we going to look back on it as one of those extraordinary years? It's because we were in the midst of a trauma and everything kind of collapsed on itself. And we basically were a little crazy during that time.
We were indeed. And the pandemic has, I guess you could say, it subsided. But those lingering effects, as you say, we are still experiencing. You talk about George Floyd in the book with the police officer killing him by standing on his neck and those protests. How did the citizens respond in Wauwatosa?
Well, all across the country, the same sorts of things happened. That was May 25th of 2020, and by the following weekend, there were protests everywhere, including Wauwatosa. But the protests were in Milwaukee, and we are surrounded on three sides by the city of Milwaukee, which is a majority-minority city. There was major unrest. There were buildings being burned and looted. There were attacks on police stations and protests. In Wauwatosa, I had to declare the first curfew of the year, 3 days, because people were driving 100 miles an hour up and down Mayfair Road, which is one of our major strips. And the police had to react to that. And this was going on in the Chicago area, the LA area, everywhere, New York City. So people just exploded in protests. And again, if you look back on it, people were out of work. People were out of school. People were scared about the pandemic. And then this horrible incident happened in Minneapolis. And people needed to vent. They vented their outrage in some ways that were appropriate and some ways that were not.
Yeah. And the we'll turn to the Kenosha unrest. I mean, Kenosha, I think you say in the book, too, it's about 45 miles from Wauwatosa, so not very far. Right. Talk right. about that a little bit.
Well, Wauwatosa is 45 miles from Kenosha, 75 miles from Madison, right next door to Milwaukee. All throughout 2020, there were major incidents happening in all three of those major cities. Kenosha, Jacob Blake, was a black man, was shot on August 23rd, and unrest, rioting broke out for a week following that. Those were horrible incidents. 8 blocks of Kenosha burned down. There were, $54 million in property damage. Buildings were burned down. Businesses were put out of operation. Kyle Rittenhouse came up, a 17-year-old came up from Illinois and killed 2 Black Lives Matter protesters. We certainly were watching that, being 45 miles away, with protests going on almost daily in Wauwatosa. And that informed the need for me to declare a curfew on October 7th, 2020, when the district attorney in Milwaukee decided not to charge our police officer for shooting and killing a black teenager.
Yeah, that was quite an experience for you to go through. That the Wauwatosa police officer had killed 3 men of color. He was Black City Police Officer Joseph Mensah. Mm-hmm. Tell us about those shootings.
Well, the first one was in 2015, the second was in 2016, and the third one was February 2nd of 2020, so just a couple months before I became mayor. Each time the district attorney reviewed the situation and determined that Officer Mensah had acted in self-defense. There were no substantial protests after the first 2 killings. There were no substantial protests after the 3rd killing until George Floyd got murdered. And then, again, because of the circumstances in 2020, things changed. And we had 98 days and nights of protests. So virtually, and it seemed like a daily occurrence. And so people were responding to that. On October 7th, as I said, that was the district attorney issued his decision that he wasn't going to charge Officer Mensah with the 3rd killing. And based on what had happened in Madison and Milwaukee, and especially Kenosha, and everywhere else across the country, and in Wauwatosa, where some of the protests had gotten violent, I declared a curfew for 5 nights. And Governor Evers sent in the National Guard. Obviously, it was a tense situation. On the cover of my book, you'll see a picture of the police and National Guard in front of Wauwatosa City Hall on October 7th of 2020.
Yeah. And we're going to go into some more detail on that. Dennis McBride, mayor of Wauwatosa, our guest today, talking about his experiences through his book. It's titled A City on the Edge, Pandemic, Protests, and Polarizations. Questions for him or maybe an experience to share, give a call, the number 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking today with Mayor Dennis McBride about his book, City on the Edge, Pandemic, Protests, and Polarization. He is mayor of Wauwatosa, and the book deals with his life as mayor. He's still mayor, as a matter of fact. He got reelected and in 2024, I believe. And so it's his experiences as a mayor during this very turbulent time in our country's history and certainly the history of Wauwatosa. Questions, experiences, share, give a call, the number 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Dennis in Two Rivers emailed to say people might be at tipping points, so the good or bad results depend on how hard they fall and on which side. Plus, it depends on how they respond. Edges can be sharp and cause bleeding. And Dennis wonders how your guest interprets being on the edge.
Well, the title of my book has a double meaning. First of all, Wauwatosa has been described in a book that came out in the 1990s as an edge city. Wauwatosa is Milwaukee's second downtown. And so we have a very urban east side and a much more suburban west side. And again, we have, you know, all these major entities, colleges and universities, a major medical center, et cetera. But the other part was, of course, our emotional edge that we and every other part of the country was on during that time. We were on an emotional edge. And so in the book, I talk about the role of mayors during times of crisis. And it is our job to calm the waters. I had one experienced communicator who's dealt a lot with police say, you're a very calm guy. And I said, well, it doesn't serve the public during crisis not to be calm. I was actually interviewed by the British Broadcasting Company, BBC, during 2020. And the interviewer asked me, what's your playbook? And I said, I hadn't thought about it that way, but I'll give you two quotes. The first is from Robert Louis Stevenson. Keep your fears to yourself and share your courage with others. And the other I said was from Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural address, where he said, we must move forward with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right. So in other words, our job is to keep people's courage up and also make sure that we follow the law and our conscience. That was my playbook and is my playbook.
And I'm thinking now about these curfews and the violent reaction to them. And you're someone who is certainly in favor of marching and protesting as long as it's done within the rules.
Absolutely, 100%. People said, so again, how did you deal with things? Well, I'm a lawyer and I've taken eight oaths of various kinds in my time, always to pledge to uphold the Constitution and the laws of the state of Wisconsin. People challenged me on that. They said, you need to fire Officer Mensa. And I said, I don't have that authority under state law. Section 6213 of the Wisconsin statutes gives that authority to the Police and Fire Commission. And one friend said to me, you're thinking too much like a lawyer. And I said, guilty as charged. I follow the law. What I do is my job is to make sure that anybody who's accused of a crime or is in danger of losing his job gets due process. That's the hallmark of our constitutional system. And if we deny people due process, we get into trouble. Milwaukee did that. The Fire and Police Commission demoted the police chief during the exact same time, during August of 2020. And they ended up paying $700,000 to Chief Morales, and they had to reinstate him. And they ended up with two police chiefs at the same time. We avoided that by following the law at every step, under a great deal of criticism. And we were negotiating behind the scenes quietly with Officer Mensa on his departure. You don't negotiate in public. You negotiate in private. So we had to take the slings and arrows while we were doing our job.
Yeah. And the protests, you called for people, please go and protest, but you need to follow the ACLU guidelines.
Right.
And at one point, I think you mentioned, even the ACLU was mad at you.
They were mad at me. at that point, I was a lifelong member of the ACLU. And they were yelling at me, and I said, just have the protesters follow your own guidelines, but you're not doing it. And then they criticized me, and they criticized the mayor of Kenosha and Governor Evers for trying to calm things down. I had two state legislators on Zoom in July of 2020, and I said, you guys need to stop this stuff. Protest, we'll protect that, but you need to follow the law. And one of them said, it's civil disobedience. I said, it stops being civil disobedience when you break the law. And he said, you need to fire the police officer. And I said, I don't have that authority. And he said, I said, if you want to change the law and let me fire police officers, I'll consider that. But I said, at this point, I have no authority. And I said, it's your job. Change the law if you want. And he said, we can't do that because the Republicans are running everything and we're Democrats. And I said, it's not my problem. I follow the law, whether the Republicans make it or the Democrats make it, I follow the law. So it was, people weren't using their brains during that time.
Yeah. And just unrelenting protest. I mean, you was it a month you had people protesting in front of your house?
Well, it was 40 days and nights over the... Seven or eight months that I was mayor during 2020. My wife won't even read my book. She says she's got PTSD. She doesn't want to relive that. It was a hellish experience having people show up at my door at 2 o'clock in the morning and chant and throw things at the house and flashlights in the windows and everything else.
And they were also at the same time, I think, in front of the police officer as well, home as well.
Yes, in fact, somebody literally took a shot at him on August 8th of 2020. And that's when I really said, and the ACLU criticized me then. The man got hit in the head with a bullhorn, and then someone fired a shotgun at him, missed him, fortunately. And I put out a statement saying, enough already, and follow the law, and we're going to prosecute people. The DA ended up convicting three people for that incident. And the ACLU still criticized me for that.
Yeah. You talk a bit about, as well, about the whole system of change in terms of Google Meets and right. The Zoom and all of that and what that was doing in terms of life. In the city and, of course, everywhere else.
Well, yeah, the 2020 changed the way we dress. You know, there were a lot of jokes about it, but we all did it. We might have looked presentable from the waist up, and then the waist down we were wearing sweatpants or shorts. People don't want to wear ties anymore. I go to meetings with other mayors and all that. If I wear a tie, I'm an outcast. It's a rare thing. I guess you wear a tie to your wedding or your funeral and a few other places. People don't want to go back to work physically. A lot of young people especially want to work from home. Really, that caused a collapse in the office market. there are all kinds of changes wrought by sitting at home during the pandemic, connecting with each other electronically. It's been a challenge for mayors and city officials to try to make sure that we maintain our property tax basis through this downturn in the office market.
Yeah, so it's something. This is one more thing to worry about as a mayor.
Yes. People ask me, why do you want to be mayor? You got all this crazy stuff going on. I find it fascinating. It's what I was trained to do, as I said earlier. But there's always a challenge, and 2020 changed everything. It really did. The challenges are not anything that could have been foreseen.
No, I don't think so either. I think at one point you mentioned somebody who quoted Alvin Toffler, who predicted, I think it was in 1980.
1980, right.
That information technology would make urban offices obsolete for work with the workers working from home. And as you say, I think he was wrong for 40 years and then he was right.
He was very right. Yeah, I think he called them electronic villages or something, but people scoffed at him. They said that'll never happen. But yeah. I will say that I tell my children who are adults, and they work part-time from home and then part-time in the office, please keep going into the office at least a few days a week. You need to establish those personal contacts with your coworkers and create mentorships and all that as well, too. So I hope we will have not lost entirely this notion that we need personal connection with each other.
I wholeheartedly agree with you on that. I'm somebody, and there are many of us, that have to be in the office every single day because we have an office, we have a radio show to do every single day. So I'm always there, and some of our folks don't have to be, or they're out covering things and away. So there's not as many people around, and it's a different kind of. I sometimes miss the conversations in the hallway and that sort of thing that happens. Probably you do too, from time to time. Yeah.
When I practiced law, it was important to be able to stroll down the hall and talk to my colleagues and bounce ideas off each other. And you wouldn't get that if we were all operating from home. So that's an essential thing.
And I'm thinking now about your meetings, city council meetings. You had lots of problems during that the time period with people not allowing the meetings to go forward.
Yeah, I was sworn in, first of all, on April 21st of 2020, almost in absentia. All the council members were on Zoom, and I was the only one there with the city clerk. On July 7th, 2020, we had a council meeting, and there were at least 100 people in the council chambers chanting and holding signs and threatening to throw things at me. One was about to throw a full bottle of water at me and got stopped. And they had guns, even though we have a prohibition on that. It was a very tense night. We couldn't get our business done. And I said, and they wanted me to talk about everything else other than what was on the agenda. And I said, I told them it'd be a violation of the Wisconsin open meetings law if we talked about things that were not on the agenda. And they said, you're not listening to us. And they screamed and yelled. And then their representative sat in the front and tried to, you know, make speeches. And finally, I called for a vote, a single vote on all the items of the night. It passed, and then we left. But as I said in the book, and this is going to be a controversial statement for some, but I stand by it, how is that really any different except in degree from what happened on January 6, 2021? It was a group of protesters trying to keep government from functioning, violating the constitutional order. I get the fact that people are upset. I've been a protester in my lifetime on different levels. I support the right to protest, but government has to go on. The change that people want can't occur if they don't allow government to function in a democratic fashion.
Dennis McBride, our guest today, talking about his life as mayor of Wauwatosa. The title of his book, A City on the Edge, Pandemic, Protest, and Polarization. Love to hear from you. Give a call if you have a question or comment or maybe an experience. The number 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. And I think you found a bullet hole in your own window of one, or at some point later, I think after it happened, but.
Right. During 2020, I told my three adult children who don't live in Wisconsin that, and this is a quote, there's a non-trivial chance that someone's going to take a shot at me. And I for 2 years, I had to look over my shoulder a lot. I still, frankly, do it a little bit. I'm always testing, looking at people's eyes to see if they're friend or foe. It's an unfortunate result. But it turned out that somebody shot a BB through the one of the windows in our enclosed front porch, and we discovered that late in the year. So who knows what that was about? I don't know who did it, but I think it was a message. And unfortunately, it was a low-key version of the much more serious messages that we've seen with Charlie Kirk and Melissa Hortman and federal judges. And we had a judge in New London, Wisconsin, who was shot a couple of years ago and killed because he had sentenced some guy 17 years earlier and all that. Nancy Pelosi's husband got beaten in their house. This is... America's always been a violent place, but we've gotten more violent politically, and that's a harbinger of bad things to come.
Rick in New Glarus has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Rick.
Thanks, Larry. Hi, Dennis. A product of your city early on, 116th and Cherry. I live next to in a duplex next to Del Crandall, a famous Milwaukee Brave. Went to grade school, had a wonderful experience as a child, and a wonderful place to grow up. Also a product of the Medical College of Wisconsin, and so I know a little bit about. I'm in rural Southwest Wisconsin now, but to hear you talk about the law and your adherence to the law in light of the current circumstances. What do you think we do when elected officials clearly don't follow the law, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of teeth to enforce the concept of following the law? And we protest, but you can see the results of protest. They don't seem to yield a lot of results. Violence in the street isn't a great answer, but it's been historically an answer in many societies when that happens. You seem to be very well spoken on this, and I would very much like to hear your thoughts.
Well, I grew up in the, thank you, Rick, and thank you for sharing your Wauwatosa memories with me, and I certainly remember Del Crandall. I grew up in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and I remember all the protests well, the anti-Vietnam protests, the civil rights movement. Martin Luther King and others started their movement in 1955 and kept going. Of course, Martin Luther King got assassinated in 1968. But a lot of people were opposed to Martin Luther King. We treat him as a saint now. People forget that many people didn't like him in the 60s, but their hearts and minds were changed when Bull Connor, the sheriff down in Alabama, was training fire hoses on protesters and sicking police dogs on them. And then there was the horrible bombing in Birmingham of the little girls in the 16th Street Church. We have to just keep pushing back. And Martin Luther King and Gandhi, I think, had the right approach, which is you can't respond to violence with violence. You have to respond to this with an adherence to the law. And unfortunately, sometimes, and we've seen this in Minneapolis in recent days, martyrdom is often the result. But we can't give up on our Constitution. We can't do an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. We have federal judges. We have federal courts. We have lawyers that are willing to step up. We have protesters who are willing to put their bodies in the streets. We have neighbors who are willing to help each other. I still subscribe to what Martin Luther King and Gandhi were doing back in those days, with unfortunate results for them. But we need leaders, and we have leaders. They go without names sometimes in Minneapolis, but they're showing us their leadership, and the unnamed lawyers who are arguing their cases in court. Those are all important things. I'm not going to give up on our Constitution because some people are violating it.
Rick, thank you for calling. Trouble in Lodi, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Trouble.
Hi, Larry. I'm so happy to be hearing your meeting, your interview with the mayor of Wildwood Costa. I can't believe what he sounds like. He sounds so intelligent, so well-read, and so proud of his legal knowledge. And I just hope that he's planning to go up the ladder and be the kind of leader we need right now at a higher level, like at the state level. I'm so happy to hear this.
Well, thank you.
Well, everyone else is running for governor. But first of all, thank you so much for those kind words. When I finish my second term in 2028, I'm going to be 74 years old. I still have a lot of gas in the tank, but I think my wife would be very unhappy if I kept climbing the ladder. But, I wrote the book in part, I hope, to inspire other leaders to follow the law and to follow the Constitution and be calm and not crumble in the face of criticism and all that. I vowed to myself when I first took office in 2008 as a alderman that I would never compromise my principles just for the sake of being reelected. I don't see a lot of people taking that vow right now. If they took that vow and they followed it, especially people in the House of Representatives right now, we'd have a very different country. So I thank you so much for your kind words. I wish I could follow up. If I were 20 years younger, maybe I would do that. But I hope this book is read and read with that in mind.
I do as well. Trouble, thank you again for calling. Mayor Dennis McBride, our guest today, Mayor of Wauwatosa, his book, A City on the Edge. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking today with Mayor Dennis McBride about his book, A City on the Edge. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let's turn to Steve in Madison next. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Good morning. Thank you for taking my phone call. And I would like to ask the mayor a question. I'm real familiar with the Twin Cities over there, and living in Western Wisconsin for many years and knowing a lot of people there. And at the peak of the George Floyd riots, the mayor of St. Paul was very clear when asked, where are all the protesters coming from? And most of them from out of state. And I'm just wondering if during the peak of the protests at Wauwatosa, if they were to identify were most of the protesters local area, or were some of them from out of the local area?
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Steve.
Well, thank you, Steve. That's a great question. I'm glad you brought it up. Yes, we were seeing people from out of state. In fact, during our curfew period of October 7th to 12th, 2020, I got a call from the mayor of Kenosha, who was expressing his support, having gone through the same hell 5.5 weeks earlier. And he said, are you seeing any outsiders? Because he said all of the trouble in Kenosha was caused by outsiders. And I said, yes, we are seeing outsiders. I said, we've got a woman named Katie from Seattle on the liberal side who's live streaming. And then we got some guy on the conservative side who's from Texas driving around live streaming, and then we've got everybody in between. And many of the arrests that were done during that curfew period, during those protests, were local people, but many more of them were from out of state. And there was a national study done by, I think, the Department of Homeland Security, and found that most of the trouble in various places around America during that time were people who are opportunists locally, or they were people from out of city, out of state. And the final point to make is nothing good happens after dark. The protests during the day were often peaceful, and the incidents that happened after dark were not. And that's why I declared my curfew from 7 p.m. to 6 a.m. every night.
Mm. Steve, thank you. Lori in Madison, we'll go to you next. Hi, Lori.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. And I appreciate the governor, or the, I'm sorry, the mayor's service. I am a retired police officer, supervisor, trainer of over 400 officers, and we never train individuals ever in any law enforcement agency to walk in front of a moving or running vehicle. You made a comparison to the fact that January 6th and what occurred in the chambers was the same. I worked with a squad and was in charge of a squad in front of the Capitol in the era of some protests. There's a lot of difference between people attacking people with weapons and sticks and other things than there is. And what I was wondering is if you could comment on if we're supposed to follow the letter of the law. And I do protest, just so you know, my right. And I wonder how we are supposed to have justice and accountability for this officer who disgraced every officer who is in uniform who has served over 30 years. And by the way, I grew up in Wisconsin on a farm, and I'm here all my life.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
I'm not quite sure of the question, but let me see if I can address it. But thank you. What I said earlier was I compared the incident in Wauwatosa to January 6th, but I said it was different in degree. So clearly what happened on January 6th at the Capitol was far worse than anything that happened in Wauwatosa. But again, people don't have a right to shut down government. On January 6th, they were trying to overturn a Democratic, small d Democratic election. In Wauwatosa, they were trying to keep us from doing our business, trying to overtake government, a democratically elected city council and a mayor who were trying to get business done for the people. So that was my point. And my point also in the book, as well as throughout 2020 and beyond, and I will say it again today, people have the absolute right to protest and assemble under the First Amendment. I'm a lawyer. I defend that. I will defend that to my death. What they don't have the right to do is to engage in violence while they're doing that, break laws about the ACLU guidelines, again, are very, very clear on this. You don't have the right to block streets. You don't have the right to drive on people's lawns. You don't have the right to shoot BB guns in people's windows. You don't have the right to fire a shotgun at somebody because you don't like them. You don't have the right to engage in behaviors at 3 a.m. that are otherwise acceptable at 3 p.m. So the First Amendment is not absolute. The Supreme Court has consistently talked about time, place, and manner restrictions on protests. And I have a chapter called Time, Place, and Manner that addresses that. We have rules that must be followed so that we can all enjoy our rights. That's what people forget, that we balance our rights because your exercise of a right may infringe on my exercise of a right or vice versa. So we have to come up with compromises and balances so that people are protected. So that's really what this is all about.
Yeah. Lori, thank you. Ruth and Eau Claire, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Ruth.
Yeah, hi. I appreciate this conversation, and I appreciate this mayor's comment and perspective. I just wanted to say that I look for the Democratic Party to have some kind of, you know, take leadership in a way that there are clear talking points. And to me, a big piece of that is the Constitution itself, but I'm not hearing it. I'm not hearing them really leading with that, standing on that, repeating that, educating our public about it. And I just, it just is like, I don't know why. I don't know why they're not doing more and even handing out the Constitution wherever they can.
Hmm. Ruth, thank you. A comment, Dennis?
Well, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I don't care if you're a Republican, a Democrat, an Independent, or a member of the Green Party. We have a Constitution. We've had a bumpy road, but it has mostly served us well. And at this time, we need the Constitution more than ever. I do close my book by referring to that notion. My final paragraph is, as ever, our society is a work in progress for all citizens. That requires not just a pledge of allegiance, but fidelity to our indivisible republic, a belief in representative government and the rule of law, and dedication to liberty and justice for all. Sounds a lot like the Pledge of Allegiance, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. It also requires a willingness to perform our civic duties. Elected officials cannot do that work alone. It is really important, and I can't emphasize that last sentence more. Elected officials cannot do this work alone. What we're seeing in Minneapolis right now with the people who are pushing back is they are representing the Constitution with their feet, with their kindness to others. But elected officials are only one part of the puzzle. The bigger part of the puzzle is everybody who has to participate through voting and participation in our democratic process and upholding our Constitution. So I couldn't agree more with you.
Ruth, thank you very much for calling. You mentioned, or you feel that being a mayor is probably the second hardest job in government after being president.
Well, that was a quote from the former mayor of Columbus, Ohio. And, you know, it was a good way to name the chapter. But we certainly have a difficult job, but we also have a great job. People say to me all the time, you have a thankless job. And I say, that is literally not mm-hmm. true, because I get thanked several times a week by people. There are others who criticize me, but that's part of the job. But we are the level of government closest to the people. I get stopped all the time. I took my swim this morning over at the health club, and people always stop me and ask me questions. And the people behind the desk say, you can't even get to the desk because you get stopped three times before, you know, you get the key for the locker. People don't always know what's going on in the state government or the federal government, but they always know what's going on in the local government because their garbage isn't getting picked up and they're not getting the snow plowed and all the rest of it. What I've always told people, and I say this in the book, I thought I invented it, but Mayor LaGuardia did almost 100 years ago in New York. There's no Democratic way to pick up the garbage and no Republican way to plow the snow. It is our job to provide those services to people that are essential to daily life. So okay. If that makes it the second hardest job in government, I willingly take that on.
Well, Dennis, we have more callers and emails. I'm really appreciate the book a lot, and I certainly appreciate the time you've taken today to be with us. Thank you so much. I hope we have a chance to talk again down the road. Thank you, Dennis.
I'd be happy to do that anytime, and the privilege has been mine, so thank you for letting me be on.
Dennis McBride, Mayor Dennis McBride, his book, A City on the Edge, Pandemic, Protest, and Polarization. A great read, and I hope you have a chance to read it, look at it, and learn from it. I learned a lot when I was reading it. And in this conversation. Coming up, we're going to switch gears and talk about some financial incentives for installing solar panels. I'm Larry Mueller.
Uh-huh.
On January 1st, the state of Wisconsin doubled the rebate it offers to homeowners switching to solar. And we're going to get the details of that from our guest, Tom Agger. Tom's the Clean Buildings Manager for Clean Wisconsin. So, do you want to save some money on a solar panel project? Maybe you have an experience to share relating to solar. Give a call. The number 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Tom Agger, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you for having me.
On January 1st, as I said, Wisconsin increased rebates for installing rooftop solar panels. Talk about the motivation for this.
Yeah, so first of all, I'll just say that the rebate's actually more than doubled. I'll get into that in a little bit. But basically, there was a federal tax credit available through the Inflation Reduction Act that provided tax credits of up to 30% of the cost of residential rooftop solar systems. Unfortunately, because of the One Big Beautiful Bill, those tax credits were terminated at the end of 2025. Focus on Energy, which is the statewide energy efficiency program, saw this sunsetting of those tax credits coming and was able to plan for that by increasing the rebates they provide for Wisconsinites.
How popular were the federal tax incentives for solar panels?
I'm not sure about the popularity of the tax incentives just because they were started so recently. However, I can say that they were projected to increase rooftop solar adoption considerably in 2026. And because of the rollback, let's see, there was a Canary Media article that shared an analysis that projected that 1.7 gigawatts less of rooftop solar would be installed in 2026 because of the rollback. So they were helping considerably with solar installation in the U.S.
Yeah, I read somewhere that I think it was in 2023, there was something like 3.4 million homeowners reaped an average of just over $5,000 federal tax credit for rooftop solar panels. So it was a considerable amount. What was the excuse for the Fed rolling those back?
I think that the federal administration talked about wanting to bring more money to the oil and gas industry and focusing on that instead of renewables. There were also concerns that some solar panels are manufactured outside of the United States. Mm.
And I imagine there was a bit of a scramble to complete solar projects before the subsidies ended in December.
Yes, there definitely was. Americans were not given much notice for the end of these tax credits. I believe the rollback was announced in July of last year, so there was probably a scramble with many projects.
Yeah. Do the state rebates help complete those projects that were started?
The state rebates can definitely help. They don't fully make up for what was rolled back. As I said, the tax credits were for up to 30% of the cost of rooftop solar systems. Meanwhile, the rebates offered through Focus on Energy are $600 per kilowatt of power, up to a maximum of $2,400 per rooftop solar system. However, the average Wisconsin home would need about 12 kilowatts of solar to offset energy use in the home. Of course, it depends on the home size and how weatherized it is, but a 12 kilowatt rooftop solar system will cost significantly more than $2,400.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I was thinking about this morning when I was doing some scrolling, And whenever I see a story relating to Scotland, I always, my ears perk up a bit because I spend a little time in Scotland just playing golf, doing nothing else, but pretty much a year or so ago. But Scotland runs entirely on wind power. It's not solar, but it runs entirely on wind power. They generate 200% of what the country needs. And they want to be fully carbon neutral by 2045. All right, maybe we can't do... I mean, Scotland's a pretty windy place. I found out as I watched my golf balls soar off to the right or left, depending on which direction the wind was blowing. But for solar, why do we want to continue to encourage, or why should we be encouraging people to use renewable energy?
Yeah, Larry, that's a great question. Renewable energy can replace more harmful forms of energy production, such as gas combustion, which contributes significantly to greenhouse gas emissions in our state and many others. Renewables are a clean form of energy that includes wind and solar, and they can significantly bring down the greenhouse gas emissions that we see in our state.
Focus on energy. How's the state increasing its assistance for residential solar panel projects?
Yeah, so Focus on Energy is funded from mandatory utility contributions, both from investor-owned utilities and from some of the co-ops in the state and the municipal utilities. Focus on Energy has an annual program budget, and within their individual programs, they're allowed to make modifications about how those program fundings are run. So they're allowed to make some modifications year to year, and then every 4 years, they go through what's called a quadrennial planning process where they plan for their program more on a grand scale for the next 4 years. So Focus on Energy is actually entering its fifth quadrennial period where it's planning for the program starting in 2027. So Focus on Energy has a little bit of leeway in what types of rebates and incentives they offer, and that funding comes from direct contributions from utilities.
I was trying to. I wish I had a dollar for every time I mentioned Focus on Energy on one show or another, because it's such a marvelous. I think, I'm sure you will agree that it's a great thing for us.
Yeah, I completely agree, Larry. I think, you know, not everyone knows about Focus on Energy or all of the incentives and rebates and free things that they can get from Focus on Energy. Focus on Energy offers Wisconsinites free energy saving packs. You just have to go to their website and tell them a little bit about yourself, and they'll send those to you. And they offer rebates on many, many things related to energy efficiency, including insulation, air sealing, energy efficient appliances, and more.
Yeah, it's an amazingly good thing in my mind. Jane in Manitowoc, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Jane.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for this great subject. I know it's not meaningful in the big picture, but I've switched all my outdoor Christmas lights to solar. But I would appreciate if your guest could address, I've heard so many things, about the lifespan of house solar panels and the disposal or recycling of them.
Yeah.
So I can speak a little bit about the lifespan. I know less about recycling of solar panels. I think rooftop solar can usually last for about 25 to 30 years. But I can't really speak to the disposal of them.
And I think I was trying to, I'm not going to speak out of turn. We've talked about this in the past on the program about the disposal of solar panels, because there is certainly, and Jane, you know, kind of brings it up, there's a concern, well, what do we do with them when they're gone? Can we recycle them? And maybe we'll have some answers before you're done here. But for the moment, I'll certainly bring it up when we touch on solar again on the program. If not today, then another day. Jane, thank you. Christina in Glenwood, we'll go to you. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. I was planning for the solar power on my farm. Elimination of tax credits ended that. Now that I hear that Focus on Energy is doing this, I'm really, you know, reconsidering. However, I must say that a couple years ago, we went forward, installed a cold weather, high efficiency heat pump based on Focus on Energy's guidelines, and they said we would receive a $500 tax credit or $500 check, which we never did receive. So I'm wondering, how did we actually go about getting that? And do I have an option to still recover that $500?
Yeah, that's a good question. Focus on Energy does offer incentives for heat pumps. I am not sure why the caller did not receive her incentive, but I would suggest reaching out to Focus on Energy directly. There's many ways to do that, including on their website or by phone. They also have regional energy advisors that you could connect with. Hopefully you'll still be able to get that incentive.
Yeah, you'll probably need some information on the, you know, the original, the what's the heat pump and, you know, and all that to make so they know that it, the heat pump was one that could be covered and so forth. But I think that's very good advice. So just go to Focus on Energy, find the contact for that, Tom, and then go that route.
Exactly. I would go to the Focus on Energy website, which is focusonenergy.com, and scroll down to their Contact Us page, and you can reach out to them, and they're very responsive.
And Joel Padnott, our producer, just let me know that the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, has information on recycling of solar panels. So if you go to epa.gov and solar panel recycling, you're going to be able to find that information as you're listening to the show today. And so I would really, our earlier caller, I'd really encourage you to go to the EPA website on recycling, solar panel recycling. I think if you just put that in, EPA on solar recycling of panels, it's going to pop up. That is almost for sure. Well, savings comparisons here. Let's talk about that a little bit. Are homeowners, or will homeowners installing solar panels save as much money with the increased state rebates as they would have had with the federal? Probably not.
Yeah, unfortunately, in most cases, not. The average rooftop solar system in Wisconsin costs about $3,200 per kilowatt. And as I mentioned before, the new Focus rebates provide $600 per kilowatt up to $2,400. So for the first 4 kilowatts of energy for a rooftop solar system, Focus is providing about an 18% discount. Whereas the federal tax incentives for the whole solar rooftop system provided up to 30% of a discount. So it doesn't quite make up for the lacking federal incentives, but it's definitely better than nothing.
And Dave emailed to say the federal credits really help mostly people rich enough to owe income taxes. For people with low or moderate incomes, the incentive wasn't there at the federal level. For people who saved to install a project, they were forced to bear the entire cost out of pocket if they did not owe federal taxes.
Yeah, so I think that's a good point, and something that relates to when it comes to low and moderate income folks is that there's a lot of other rebates and incentives available specifically to them. While the solar federal tax credits were rolled back, there are two really important rebate programs that Wisconsin can offer because of federal money that haven't been rolled back. Those are the home electric appliance rebates and the home efficiency rebates. Those, the appliance rebates are specifically for low and medium income households, and they offer up to $14,000 and up to 100% of project costs for installing certain energy efficient electric appliances. So while solar might not be as accessible for low to moderate income households, there are a lot of rebates available to help with other things, such as if your stove breaks and you want a new and efficient electric stove or a heat pump, for example.
So, and where did they go to learn more about that?
Yeah, so Focus on Energy is also the administrator of those two programs. So they can go to Focus on Energy's website and then click on, under the residential menu, they can click on the home energy rebates to find out about those two programs.
John wonders in an email, how much have solar panels improved over the years? Do they do a better job now than they did 20 years ago, as I guess what he's asking?
I'm not sure about the improvement of solar panels over the years, unfortunately.
The utility savings here. How much can a rooftop solar system decrease a homeowner's utility bill?
Yeah, I mean, on sunny days, a good rooftop solar system can fully offset the energy use in a home in Wisconsin. And so on certain days, they can have virtually no utility bill.
Yeah, and then I'm sure people are wondering how quickly can a rooftop solar system pay for itself?
Yeah, I think I have to check on this, but I think the payback period is 10 to 15 years, just about, for a rooftop solar system.
So you've got, let's say, 10 years. So, and you were talking about one lasting... A typical rooftop may last,
25 years?
Yeah. Be on the conservative side, say 25 years. So if it goes 10 years, it's paying itself back. You wind up with another 15 years where it's kind of paying, I mean, your money ahead for 15 years.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a lot of benefit, and let's go back again to the costs. So a solar panel, what does a typical solar panel array cost?
Yeah, so for Wisconsin, if we're talking about per kilowatt, I'd say about $3,200 per kilowatt, and obviously, the size of homes in Wisconsin vary significantly, but the average capacity needed for a Wisconsin home to fully offset electricity use is around 12 kilowatts, so around $40,000 in upfront cost for the average rooftop solar panel system in Wisconsin. Again, that will vary significantly depending on who you're working with, the size of your home, how efficient your home is. The reason I bring up home efficiency is because, as I mentioned, there are a lot of efficiency rebates available. I recommend that homeowners try to make their home as efficient as possible, as much as they can before they install a rooftop solar system, because then their home would require a rooftop solar system that has less capacity and therefore costs less.
And of course, Focus on Energy can help with that whole practice.
Exactly.
Explain how that works.
Explain how focus on energy can help.
Yeah, in that regard. We mentioned it many times on the show, but it always is worth mentioning again.
Yeah, so a lot of Wisconsin homes are not that new. They were built decades ago, and they probably don't have the best insulation. They don't have the best air sealing. And so the home isn't as efficient as it should be. When you're heating your home, heat is leaking out of it, and your system is having to work harder than it should. Because of that, you're paying more for utility bills than you should be. Focus on Energy offers incentives and rebates to help fix that insulation, help fix that air sealing, so that you have a tighter home and your heating system doesn't have to use as much energy to heat your home or cool your home in the summer. Because of that, you would need fewer solar panels on your roof to offset your energy costs. So Focus on Energy has so many great resources. I recommend everyone go to their website and click the Get Started button on the top right corner, and it'll walk you through, based on your income, your zip code, and the size of your home, which rebates are available to you.
Yeah, I've used Focus on Energy for, my house is an Energy Star home. Because I did all the work in the home. Before that, I went through a home energy audit through Focus on Energy, and you get this step by step. You know, here's what you, if you can't do it all at once, here's what you should do first, here's what you should do second, here's what you should do third. It's just a marvelous educational experience, and financially sound, if you're thinking that way, experience to get your home up to where it should be.
Totally. And, you know, a home energy audit or assessment, like you mentioned, it's basically like your yearly checkup at the doctor. And unfortunately, we're not doing that as frequently for our homes, but you have no idea about the health of your home and how leaky it is, and how much energy you could save if you made some small fixes. And so an energy assessment, someone will come and walk through your home, and they'll analyze different parts of it, and they'll tell you which upgrades could save you the most energy. That way you're spending your money wisely and you're seeking out the rebates that you should be.
Yeah, that blower door test and so forth is really cool to watch.
Yeah.
Especially this time of the year is a really good time to do it, because it's cold outside, and so as you watch those red waves in the air, say, oh, that's heat that's going out of my house that I could fix.
Yeah, I mean, Larry, I'm sitting next to a window right now, and I can tell you that heat is leaking out of it. I can tell.
Tom, a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for being with us today. We'll look forward to another visit from you down the road. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tom Egger is the Clean Buildings Manager for Clean Wisconsin. Great to have him with us. We are going to turn our attention to milk. Do you ever think we'd talk about whole versus 2% versus 1% versus skim? Well, we're going to do that next with a registered dietitian, Andrea Miller. I'm Larry Mueller. As of January 14th, and for the first time, federal dietary guidelines recommend schools serve whole milk to children. In Wisconsin, we drink more milk than most Americans, I think. I'll find out when we ask our guests here. But, you know, the question's always been, is full-fat milk healthy or harmful to kids? And here to answer that question, Andrea Miller. Andrea is a registered dietitian and the outreach program manager for the Center for Dairy Research at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And as we talk with her, I hope you'll join in. What do you want to know about how healthy different kinds of milk are, perhaps, and how they might relate to your own kids or grandkids. Give us a call. The number, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Andrea Miller, welcome. Thanks for joining in. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
So, on January 14th, President Trump signed into law new legislation that allows whole milk and 2% milk to be served in school cafeterias. Maybe first, what kind of milk have school children been drinking up to this point?
Sure. So traditionally, it's been skim and 1%. A lot of schools have been taking out the chocolate milk option as well. So this is a big change. I've been a dietitian for 25 years, and this is a big change that I haven't seen before.
Yeah. Well, I think since 2012, schools receiving federal funding through the National School Lunch Program, is what I think it's called, could provide low-fat or 1% milk.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So what was the reasoning for that?
Well, there's an advisory board that helps guide the U.S. dietary guidelines. And sometimes it can appear contradictory, you know, so we've known this for so many years, and now you're saying that 2% in whole is okay. What happened? It's not necessarily that it discounts the previous studies. It's just the advisory board stays current on the studies, and it kind of adds to the body of knowledge that drives these guidelines and these recommendations. And I will point out to say that the guidelines aren't specifically stating that only 2% in whole should be provided, but offered as an option. It can be offered as an option now.
So is it healthy for school-age children?
Yeah, that healthy word is kind of a loaded one. I do have a difficult time as a nutrition professional attaching that word healthy to a single food or a single nutrient. So I'll kind of start with that.
Okay.
Looking at healthy is more of a way of being, necessarily pinpointing certain foods as healthy or not healthy or good or bad can be kind of dangerous in a sense that it can give mixed messages. So with all that, I can break it down. When you look at the different varieties of milk options. So if we just start with skim, 1%, 2% whole, right?
Okay.
Essentially, all the nutrients are very similar in terms of carbohydrate, protein, your vitamins, and your minerals.
How much protein?
8 grams in 1 cup. So 1 gram per ounce in milk. So milk's a very solid protein choice.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, we always said three cups of milk a day or three glasses of milk a day. That was the, I think, when I was growing up.
Sure. So when you look at the different levels, really the only difference between skim 1%, 2% and whole is the fat content and the calorie content. The nutrients are the same across the board. The other nutrients are similar across the board.
So here's what I'm thinking, tell me if I'm right or wrong. I'm thinking that the original was the reason for 1% or 2% is we don't want our kids to get fat.
I think you're spot on. So the concern is, or shall I say the assumption is, kids are getting enough fat in the other things that they're eating, or they're getting enough calories. We don't need to add to it by, adding in, because milk, regardless of the fat percentage or the fat level, the other nutrients are the same. Why not have them get all those nutrients without the extra fat and calories? There's a caveat to that. Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So, but if you have the situation where it's not palatable and a child thinks, I don't like skim milk, I'm not going to drink milk at all, then you just took out that whole category of nutrition that you can't really get anywhere else in that perfect little package.
Yeah. Well, let's look at some evidence or research. What's the evidence that drinking full fat milk can lead to obesity and heart disease?
Yeah, that's a stretch. That's a little bridge too far in a sense that we don't eat foods in isolation, right? We don't eat nutrients in isolation. So we have to take into consideration, again, why we don't want to label specific foods as good, bad, healthy, unhealthy, because we eat nutrients together. We eat them as a package. We eat foods together. So if you're having one component of your meal that has fat in it, maybe the other component of your meal doesn't, and you just balanced it out. So we have to take that into consideration that we can't isolate certain foods, and we can't just assume that kids are getting too much fat. Maybe some kids, their school lunch meal, their school milk drink is 75% of their nutrition for the day. We don't know that. And so we can't make these overarching recommendations when we don't know what, you know, what kids' situation is. And I just go back to, as a dietitian and a nutritionist, is I'm thinking nutrients. What am I getting, or what is my child getting out of what they're consuming? And milk is one of the most nutrient-dense foods out there. Yeah. And so if a kid can get that with some extra fat that they might actually need, or a little extra calories that they might actually need to get through the day, I'm all for it.
Stephen Madison called but couldn't stay with us. Wants to know if the ability to digest milk proteins changes over a person's lifetime, or can it change?
Yeah, good question. It's not so much the ability to metabolize or break down the protein as is our tolerance to the sugar, the natural sugar in milk, lactose. So lactose is probably the most common intolerance amongst adults. Kids tend to metabolize it very well. So if you recall being able to drink, you know, a gallon of milk a week when you were young, and now you look at a glass of milk and it kind of gives you a queasy stomach, that's kind of a normal thing. So when we're talking nutrient intake, for instance, and we're talking adults versus kids, that's also something very important to consider. Kids' intake of milk and dairy, they might be getting those nutrients through milk alone, meaning they're not eating the other foods. Adults might be eating yogurt. They might be eating cheese, which for the lactose side of things is very well suited, because lactose isn't as, you're not as affected. Your body doesn't have to do as much work to break down any lactose that might be in cheese or yogurt.
Mm. So what's, if I've got a cup of milk and I'm looking at protein, and how much, this is maybe an aside, but you may not be prepared to answer, and I've got a hunk of cheddar cheese.
Mm-hmm.
How much cheddar cheese would I have to eat to sort of be the equivalent of 8 ounces of milk?
Yeah, that's a good question. So you're talking, how can I get 8 grams of protein out of a piece of cheese? You're talking about 1 ounce to 1.5 ounces.
Okay.
So a very reasonable amount. And if we're talking, when you made that reference at 3 glasses of a day, the other way to think of that, in the modern terms, is think of that 3 servings of dairy a day. So you could get that through a serving of milk, a serving of cheese, and coffee with your milk. Or, milk with your coffee in the morning. So it doesn't have to be 3 whole glasses. We can consume milk differently.
I have a cup of yogurt every day.
Mm-hmm.
So what's a cup of yogurt in terms of, I think the yogurt that I get has like 20 grams.
Yeah.
I actually pay more money for by, I don't know, 50 cents or whatever, a carton to get the 20 grams.
Sure, sure. Yogurt's a little different situation because there's so many more variables with yogurt. If it's slow strained, it's going to have some more protein in it versus traditional. So there's a few more variables in terms of the nutrition profile in different yogurts. Whereas, again, milk on its own, 8 ounces per 8 ounces, whether it's skim, 1%, 2%, or whole, the nutrient profile is essentially the same.
It's the same thing.
Except for the fat and the calories.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. And interesting, and how they take that out.
Right. And yeah, and those
goes back to some pretty interesting leadership at the UW way back in the day.
Mm-hmm. And it also begs the question when you're talking about human beings, right?
Yeah.
If they're consuming something that doesn't have as much fat in it, are they going to try to get fat in other foods? Versus if they have a glass of 1% milk or whole milk, excuse me, are they going to be satisfied and not searching for other things to eat?
Yeah.
So there's that whole human aspect, too, that we have to consider, that whole behavior kind of aspect and listening to. We hear a lot about satiety now and getting fuller sooner and that kind of thing, and paying attention to that feeling of being satisfied. So a lot will argue that, you know, you take the whole milk, especially with kids, they're more satisfied throughout the day. They have more concentration to learn better. They're not reaching for snacks because they're not missing that extra nutrition or fat or calories. So there's something to be said for that, too.
Absolutely. Andrea Miller, our guest today. Andrea is a registered dietitian and the outreach program manager for the Center for Dairy Research at UW-Madison. We've been talking about milk with her and the new guidelines that have come out relating to whole milk and 2% milk. Questions for her? I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're talking with Andrea Miller, a registered dietitian and part of the Center for Dairy Research at the UW-Madison. Great to have her with us. And questions, I hope you'll join in again at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Amy in Milwaukee wonders, is it better for a child to drink chocolate milk rather than no milk at all? And I've had parents say, my kid doesn't like white milk and only wants chocolate milk.
Mm-hmm. Excellent question. My short answer is yes. The fact that...
It's better.
It's better, yes. A few reasons being, one, you don't get, especially for a kid, you do not get the nutrition profile in anything else. And if they're not drinking it, the question is, what are they drinking? And there isn't an alternative out there that is going to match up to the nutrition that a child needs, that is the matrix of all the nutrients working together, in addition to the list of the nutrients that milk provides. The other thing to consider, kind of a different concept to consider, is when you add sugar to milk, if you're flavoring it chocolate, it doesn't take away the nutrition. The nutrition doesn't go away, right?
No.
Just like if you add sugar to your high-fiber cereal. If that's a way for you to eat high-fiber cereal, great. It's not going to discount the nutrition by adding sugar to it. And in fact, we have to pay attention that our kids may be satisfied with that and then not reaching for other sugary things throughout the day because they're getting satisfied with what they need.
You know, as we were talking here, I was flashing back on Wisconsin State Fair when Herb Kohl was senator. And he always had a booth where you could get free milk, and he would have strawberry milk and chocolate milk and cherry milk and every different flavor you could imagine. I always enjoyed stopping there and trying a different
a different flavor. Yeah,
one of the different flavors that he had. And why not? If that's what they're going to, only thing they'll drink.
Right. And it could be reassuring to know also that flavored milk in schools has nearly 60% less added sugar than it did 20 years ago. So we're making advances. We're trying to, and that's one of the things that we do at the Center for Dairy Research, is how can we keep milk safe and of good quality, and how can we keep it in high demand? So how can we work with products that people are going to consume? Because if you don't consume the nutrition, or you don't consume the product, then what's the point?
What's the point? Yeah. Will in Oshkosh, we'll go to you. Hi, Will.
Well, thanks very much. I'm an 80-year-old plus guy, normal weight, etc. Lactose is fine with me. Are there great virtues or no virtues, or what virtues in drinking whole milk at my age? What's the science on that?
Sure. I mean, the biggest, it's going to be a little bit subjective at this point. The objective, or kind of the nutrient information, would be that you are consuming dairy products, right, to get that valuable nutrition. And then it's kind of your personal preference. You know, if I have somebody that's consuming skim or 1% and is fine with it and sees no issues, I wouldn't make them go to 2% or whole milk. But if you're thinking, gosh, I really miss whole milk, and if I drink 6 to 8 ounces of it and I'm satisfied, I say, go for it. So a lot of it at this point is a palatability, a taste preference, just kind of how satisfied it makes you feel when you consume it.
Yeah. And, you know, when you're at that skim stage, it's almost like drinking water.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you could get used to it, but if you don't have to, why?
Why
go down that road, right?
Jerry and Kokana, will go to you. Thank you for calling.
Yes, I was curious about milk and some of the, if it inhibits some of, like, the polyphenols and the isoflavones in certain vegetables or spices. And I've heard, like, well, if you drink green tea with a spot of milk like the English do, you're kind of defeating some of the purpose. Can you talk about that and how milk affects some of those nutrients and stuff?
Yeah.
I don't know how much of it is validated enough that it would make a difference, you know, in someone's overall diet. I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah, that's one I haven't heard about either. But not to say that it's not there, as Jerry is pointing out to us.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry, we'll have to look into that and get back to you on that, because I honestly don't know either. Paula in La Crosse, thank you for calling.
Oh, hi. Thank you. Well, hey, I'm a fellow registered dietitian. I retired about 5 years ago, but I was 35 years. And I just wanted to point out, I was just extremely shocked when friends of mine and their kids and daughter-in-laws were substituting giving their children cow's milk, which we recommended whole milk until the age of two. But they were substituting the nut milk, seed milks, from almond milk to oat milk. And I pointed out, oh, my gosh, there is zero protein. And I think people don't understand this, that there is, unless it's soy milk. And certainly if you have an allergy, whatever it might be. But I just wanted to point that out. I think it's very, very, very disheartening. And yes, there's so many individual circumstances, but I just wanted to point that out.
Yeah, that's an excellent point to make. And I spent about 9 years in retail as a dietitian before coming to the Center for Dairy Research. And that was apparent, the lack of understanding of the difference in nutritional profile between a plant-based milk and a dairy milk. It's not even comparable. Soy milk is probably the most comparable if you had to find an alternative. But when we talk about lactose as being an issue, for one, the best alternative or substitution, if you will, is dairy milk simply with the lactase enzyme. So whatever percent fat you enjoy, but just getting the lactose-free dairy milk is your best option because you don't lose out on any of the nutrition. Plant-based versus dairy milk, not even comparable in terms of protein digestibility, the matrix of nutrients. We're not talking about even the same set of standards.
Yeah, and a lot of people were very upset when it came out that it would be okay to call these other drinks as milk.
Sure.
Because they're sort of riding on the coattails of milk when, in fact, they're not.
Right, right. And way back, that started as a consumer protection law, right? So similar to the likes of fruit and fruit juice, why you see 100% fruit juice, and if it's not 100%, you see the added word cocktail or drink. That's to alert the consumer that that's not 100% juice and you're not getting the nutrient, the fruit nutrition that you might be expecting. Or fruit isn't spelled correctly. That's a consumer protection to point out to the consumer. So we're trying to advocate that for milk so consumers understand it's okay to consume the other products, but don't expect the nutrition from a plant-based beverage that you would be getting from dairy milk because it's just not the same.
Pam emailed to say she's 64 and drinks about 2 to 2.5 gallons of skim milk a week. It's her go-to drink. Are there downsides to drinking too much milk?
I mean, there's downsides to excess of anything, right? But I wouldn't necessarily consider that too much. And I would say if it's working for her body and it's working in her lifestyle, then I would say keep doing it.
Yeah. Kathy in Greenleaf, you have a question.
Yes, I have two grown sons who, all the while they were growing, they would probably, between the two of them, consume a gallon of milk a day. We were always buying milk.
Mm-hmm.
Now that they're in their 40s, they all of a sudden, they are allergic. They say they're allergic to milk, and they've also developed a gluten intolerant. So
how does that happen?
You know, how does this happen?
Yeah, that's kind of a longer answer. In terms of milk, you have both a situation where you could be intolerant to the lactose, which is the most common, and that's simply age is a big deal with that, with just a lacking of the enzyme. And allergy is a different situation. That's talking about the protein in the milk. So the first would be to identify which is which. Is it an intolerance to lactose or is it an allergy to milk? And so as far as, like I said, with the lactose, it's very common with adults. Very simple substitutions, however, like the lactose-free dairy milk, as I mentioned, store brand or, you know, name brand, doesn't matter. Nutrition is the same. And ultra-filtered milk also, ultra-filtered, not ultra-processed, ultra-filtered milk will also be low, if not free of lactose.
Mm. And Andrea Dale emailed to ask the benefits of A2 milk, someone who has difficulty digesting it?
Sure. So A2 has to do with the protein. So cows produce a combination of A1 and A2 protein in milk. But some people do have a sensitivity or a intolerance to the A1. And so if they consume A2, they may feel better or digest the milk better. Nutrients across the board, though, however, are the same. So the dairy nutrition is the same, which is great.
Andrea, it's a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much. Will you come back and be with us again down the road?
Certainly.
Love to have you back. Andrea Miller, a registered dietitian and the outreach program manager for the Center for Dairy Research at UW-Madison. Great to have her with us. And we'll get her back. Tomorrow on Garden Talk, some tips on growing peppers from the executive director of All American Selections and National Garden Bureau. And then we'll take a look at Orchid Quest. Big thanks, of course, to our guests today, and of course to our team as well. So it's always a team effort. I'm the guy on the air most of the time, but there are lots of people that are making me sound smart and look good. Clara Nyper, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadol. I'm Larry Mueller again, and thanks for listening. And stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.